Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozworski, and welcome to the show. Of all the economic hot topics of the past few years, few have generated more heat than inequality. Whether it's constant references to the Occupy Wall Street slogan of the 99% versus the 1%, or Thomas Piketty's tome on capitalism and inequality topping bestseller lists, inequality talk is all around us. And this is as it should be, for inequality itself is visible everywhere and rising, the rich and poor growing apart in wealth and income in countries across the world. I have two guests to talk inequality today. First up is Branko Milanović. One of the world's foremost experts on inequality, Branko is professor at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City, where he also heads the Luxembourg Income Study Center. He's the former chief economist at the World Bank's research unit and author of The Haves and the Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. I'm also happy to have Armin Yalnızyan back on the show as my second guest. Armin is a senior economist at the Center for Policy Alternatives in Ottawa. The center has done extensive research into inequality in Canada, and that's what I'll be speaking with Armin about. One final note, I have to apologize in advance for the so-so quality at times. The equipment was not cooperating this week. Without further ado then, my conversation with Branko Milanović on global inequality. Branko, I wanted to start with a picture of global inequality, not only because this is one of your research interests, but also because I think it sometimes gets lost in the focus and in the focus on the U.S. in particular. I think you've written quite a bit about the fall in inequality between countries that's accompanied the growth within countries. Maybe you could give just a sort of, you know, snapshot picture of what global income inequality evolution has looked like recently.
Okay, so, you know, global income inequality is really defined as inequality between individuals. So in principle, it's the same as inequality within a country if you were to assume that the world is like one country. So that's really inequality between all people in the world. Surely we have to allow for the differences in price levels. That's really an important difference between national inequalities and global inequalities, because differences in price levels between countries in Africa and, let's suppose, Norway are enormous, and obviously you have to allow for the fact that things are much cheaper in Africa, for example, food or, you know, housing, than they are in Norway. So having done all of that, then the basic story is as follows, is that, of course, the level of global inequality is extremely high, so it is higher than any individual country, which is not surprising. But what is interesting is that level, to the extent that we can really determine, we believe that actually has been, in the last 10 years approximately, has been slightly going down. In other words, all the evidence that we have points to a downward trend, if I can call it like that, except that we are not sure exactly if it is, you know, a larger trend or smaller, whether the decline is larger or smaller. But it is going down. And the reason why it is going down is essentially because relatively poor countries and populous countries like China, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, and so on have had now 15 or 20 years of very high growth rates, higher than growth rates in the rich countries, and they are the ones who are pushing global inequality down. And the final point is that all happens while at the same time inequalities within each of those countries that I mentioned, or the US or many countries in the European Union, are going up.
I think an interesting way of putting this that I've seen you write is basically a sort of different trajectory of two middle classes, one broadly in the north and the other broadly in the south, with them sort of pulling in different directions, and actually moving closer together because of income stagnation in the north and this rapid income growth that you've talked about in the south. How has this worked, and how has the integration of the global south sort of caused this, you know, contributed to this dynamic?
You know, it's interesting because, of course, as you said, we have, if we define middle class as people who would be just generally considered middle class in Western countries, who are by global standards quite well off, and then we also define use a little bit different definition for the class in the global south, who would be people who will be by Western standards poor, but because their countries like China, Indonesia, and so forth are obviously much richer than U.S. or Canada, within their national boundaries, they are actually considered middle class. So there are really basically two misclasses, if you will. One is the Western middle class, and another is maybe you can call it emerging economies middle class. And what has happened over the last 15 to 20 years is that in the Western countries, the middle classes have generally had very sluggish growth or even zero growth. And this is true not only for the U.S., which is, of course, quite well known, but it's also true for Germany, which is less well known, or for Japan, where really stagnation of both wages and real incomes. And then on the other hand, you had this emerging middle class, who I have to really underline every time, is still much poorer than the middle class in the West, which actually had very significant rises in real income, and over the last 25 years, more than doubling. This is especially the case in China, in urban China, but also rural China, and as I said, mentioned before, other Asian countries. So they're becoming more similar in terms of incomes because one group, poorer group, is increasing, and the better off group is actually stagnant. And in that sense, we can actually speak of some kind of global middle class, although I'm not really a huge fan of that term because it really mixes up or combines these two classes that are really different in terms of income.
Right. So I guess speaking of a real kind of leveling is a very far off, towards a more, to use the old language of what was once called the global working class, is still a ways off in terms of them sharing an actual level of income.
Yes, I think it is, we do actually speak now of something like a global middle class in a more casual way, but the significant, and even people whom people in the West essentially perceive as middle class in poorer countries like India, I suppose, are actually within their own countries, are actually people who are in the top 5% of the distribution. So they're not really people at the median, because the median or real middle in those countries would be still significantly below the level of the median in the West. I mean, to just give you an idea, for example, the social assistance or the poverty line in most rich countries, kicks in at $15 per day. And this is income level that is fairly high by emerging market standards, where actually the median income could be, $6 or $7 or $8 per day. So it's really relatively low.
And what if we move to the extremes on both sides of this, the very wealthiest and the very poorest, also in sort of global terms? Is it more fair to speak of a global oligarchy, a global really wealthy class that's more similar, regardless if it's in Mexico City, the city of London, or Shanghai?
Yes, it's true. Basically, I think the last quarter of a century is to some extent, characterized by, at the same time, the emergence of what we just talked about, the global middle class, and also the emergence of some kind of global plutocracy, which is relatively small in percentage terms. These are people who share, similar incomes, similar lifestyles, interests, and so on, and who might live in all these half a dozen or actually maybe more a dozen metropolises in the world. But nevertheless, I mean, it is also true that even a group, which is probably about the, we're talking about global 1%, which was about 70 million people, has seen significant gains. So essentially, what has happened is that you had really large increases in real income around the middle of the income distribution. You had, what I mentioned before, stagnation amongst people who are relatively well off globally, but within rich countries, they're really middle class. They have not seen much of growth. And then you had this global plutocracy, the global top 1%, with large increases in real income. So that's kind of a very mixed picture of what has happened over the last 25 years.
I really liked a short quote from one of your talks. You said we shouldn't focus on what you call delta economics, so not looking only at the changes and forgetting about the levels. What do we lose when the debate becomes too much about, you know, has inequality gone up a bit this year or gone down a bit? Is there something important that gets lost?
We have become, as I think, society very much, without maybe realizing it fully, a society in the sense really that people talk about changes. Now, I'm not saying that changes are unimportant. Obviously, they are very important. We talk about growth rate. But, you know, when you look at the change compared to the level, obviously the changes are always small on an annual basis or even 5 years or more. And we sometimes tend to forget the massive differences in income levels. Just take the example, for example, of China and the U.S. Of course, we know that China is growing faster, and it is, you know, even in nominal terms, nominal dollar terms, might catch up with the United States on, you know, it's going to take a while for per capita basis, but overall income of China. But we forget that there, of course, differences between the two countries are, you know, very significant in income levels. In PPP terms, the ratio 4-1. So we should not really become only obsessed with changes. And even what I was saying before about the global middle class that did register, you know, doubling of their real incomes, these real incomes are still small. And when you look at actually where the absolute gains over the same 25 years were the most important, they were most important among the rich people. And it's very simple to explain. If I'm rich and I have, you know, $1,000 per day and I get just, you know, 1% increase, it would be $10. But, you know, another person at $10 per day and might have a doubling of his real income, so he would get $10 as well. So in absolute terms, we get the same, but in percentage, they get much less. And we really focus only on that. And I think it's not the full picture.
Yeah, and I think there's important political implications to all of this. You know, it's one thing exactly that the rising inequality has given rise to this new class of plutocrats, and even, you know, that's been able to augment its income and its wealth, but it also gives rise to a kind of vicious circle, right? So it's not just that it's has bigger reasons to consolidate its gains at the expense of others at the same time as getting ever greater means to do so. And I think I've seen you speak to this as well, that, you know, that it's really fair to talk about this as a kind of plutocracy.
Yeah, you know, what of course is the danger there, and I think to some extent it's already kind of in the process of materializing itself as a danger, is that economic power, which oftentimes is actually acquired through a combination of political and economic power, that economic power at some point tends to be translated more and more into political power, which essentially means sort of an attempt or maybe ability of the rich people to design the rules which are in their own favor and to maintain these rules. And I think that is what we see at the level of nation state, you know, quite often, because that's where the governments operate. And we also see that at the level, at the global level, although there, of course, the governance rules are different, but, you know, still through the organizations like the IMF, the World Bank, World Trade Organization, or through informal gatherings like Davos and others, you're essentially having a group of people who are very rich trying to sort of determine, you know, global rules. And just the pure sort of factoid, we are talking about really people who are extremely rich. I'm talking about billionaires in this case, not about, you know, the 70 million of top 1%, but we're talking really about the select group. If you just simply look at the list and keep the same level of real wealth over the last 20 years, and these are people who had now 2 billion because you have to adjust for the price increases, you see that they have actually gone from having something like, I cannot remember, you know, 4%, their wealth was equal to 4% of global GDP, and it's now 8%. So it's clearly that they have, these very wealthy people have become even richer.
Right, and have the power to continue being able to accumulate that.
Yeah, I actually have, I mean, I think to a large extent have been able, or maybe they would even become more able to do that, to decide on the rules. And I think potentially it is, it is a danger both for democracies at the national level, which then really would become less meaningful, because if you have many of the economic decisions determined, you know, externally, then really what you really decide in your own country is not that much. I mean, and then secondly, of course, there would be the global rules that might influence.
Right, and I think we're seeing that not just in the where we saw it in the South, but starting to see it in the North as well, especially within the European Union, where the external rules are really determining a lot about, you know, your room of movement internally as well.
Yeah, I think actually what has I think also become clear is that you know, the this division, which was kind of sharper between the North and the South, let's put it like that, is now really being blurred, and it's partly being blurred because, of course, the South is becoming relatively richer because it's kind of in some ways catching up with the North, but also the political systems are becoming to some extent more similar. In other words, it's not, for example, evident that money plays less a role in the U.S., for example, or in South Africa. In other words, you know, this what used to be called you know, political capitalism has become, I think, also more prevalent in the older democratic countries.
Branko Milanović, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you very much for you know, inviting me. It was a pleasure.
That was noted inequality scholar and CUNY Graduate Center prof Branko Milanović on inequality across the world. Now, to look at inequality in Canada, here's my conversation with Armini Alnizian of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. Well, Armin, I thought we could begin with a portrait of the degree of wealth and income inequality in Canada. What does the gap between rich and poor look like in our neck of the woods, our neck of the global north?
Well, definitely we're not as bad as the United States. Of course, nobody does extreme like the U.S., so we always look more moderate than the Americans. But what's true is our income inequality is higher today than it was 30 years ago. It grew more rapidly in the 90s than in the United States. The pace of growth was more dramatic in the 90s than in the United States. The issue for me looking at income inequality is from about the mid-1970s to the from about 1997 to 2007, Canada was a job juggernaut. It just created more in relation to its labor market than any other country in the G7. So the question is, under those conditions of incredibly rapid economic growth, why did inequality rise rather than settle or go further down? I mean, what would it take to reduce income inequality is the big story that I think gets often overlooked. Is are we doomed to deal with elevated levels of income inequality?
And is this just sort of global pressures and pressures coming up from the U.S., or is that also something that's inherent? You know, is this the general decline of the welfare state as well that's producing this? What are some of the hypotheses around?
Well, definitely we've seen the tax part of the transfer in tax system doing less than it used to redistribute incomes. But if you look at just the market incomes, you're seeing an increasing concentration of income and consequently wealth. Where people at the top, you see, you know, income inequality used to be a story about what happened to people at the bottom in the course of recessions. Even those at the very top of the distribution would be impacted by the rise and the fall of the economic cycle. And now we're seeing that income inequality is not widened primarily because of what happens to them, because they lose their jobs, you know, and so on and so forth, but because of what happens at the top. That's not to say that they don't get dinged. In fact, in this most recent crisis, those at the very top get a considerable reduction in their incomes, much more so than in the United States, which I found really interesting. But they bounce back more quickly. And we've seen over time reduced income mobility, which means those who are at the top tend to stay within a few percentage points of the top. I mean, there'll be movement, but not a whole lot, and less movement upwards from the bottom. Very few people actually make that rags to riches transition. There'll always be people you could point to, but the degree of that kind of upward economic mobility has slowed over the decades as incomes and wealth become more concentrated. And don't forget, the flip side of economic mobility is people at the top have to go down. Right.
Right. And a stratification to then according to, you know, culture and everything sort of becomes separated because you have less of this sort of intermingling economically. And that, I think, stratifies society as well, that you have, you know, separate sort of cultures developing, especially for those at the top who don't have to deal with being different as much.
When most of the gains in economic growth translate to incomes for those at the top rather than the middle and the bottom, then they have a windfall of cash. And they tend to, you know, the biggest thing people buy in their lives, if they're going to buy a house, is a house. And real estate agents will tell you all about location, location, location. So what the rich do, or people with the highest gains in their disposable income do, is they bargain up the price of the most desirable locations. And then that has a kind of jet stream effect, that the next most desirable location will see their the price of that real estate go up, and so on and so forth, until what you're left with for people that don't have a lot of money more polarized geographies where people are pushed into low-rent neighborhoods. And what does low-rent mean? You got lousy schools, you've got lousy public services like transit, you've got lousy access to either retail shopping or to green space. And so consequently, income inequality translates within the course of 10, 20 years, increasing geographic polarization, which has longer term implications. If kids only, you know, rich kids go to schools that only other fairly well-heeled kids go to and don't meet children from lower income neighborhoods, and vice versa, you get more of what is in economics positive sorting, where likes marry likes, or if they hang out with likes, you only see people that are just like you, and you start thinking that that's the reality, that you're rich or poor. And there's fewer neighborhoods in the middle, these kind of bridging neighborhoods that have a bit of an economic mix. It translates from a pure income phenomenon into a culturally lived phenomenon, as well as a geographic proposition. And we've certainly seen that in most of our big cities.
Maybe I could ask a question that sort of goes back to what you were talking about at the very start, but comes out of this a bit too. I wanted to know what's distinctive about inequality in Canada as well, especially as being this this large country and seeing a kind of uneven development, you know, not just in inequality, but economically, especially with the commodity booms and the most recent oil boom. Are there regional components to inequality in Canada? Are these commodity booms having big effects on inequality as well?
Oh, without doubt, there's a regional aspect. I mean, one of the reasons why our inequality trends have not continued to spike up in the last, about 2002 to the most recent years we have on record, which sadly is only 2011, we're wildly out of date in having data for income inequality trends, which is not an accident. The regional, what looks like stasis for Canada as a nation, shows huge regional divergences. And of course, commodity prices will create some of that divergence. But don't forget, commodity prices, while you get more inequality in areas that have a resource boom, you also have wages going up at the bottom than we've ever seen before. A lot of people are getting jobs, and that's the number one thing, is to get jobs. If you want to reduce inequality, you want employment. So there's more than one thing that's been going on regionally. If you take a look at the Gini coefficient and you say, oh, look, it's been kind of steady for a while in Canada. Why is that? One is these various trends across the regions. Two other reasons are women's labor force participation rates are far more accelerated here in Canada than in the States, and they've been continuing to climb until the last few months of 2014, actually, compared to in the United States, where there's been a steady decline. I mean, nobody has looked into this deeply, but part of the theory of why more Canadian women are forced than in the United States, and that trend continues. The two major reasons people point to is that post-secondary education is more affordable here, and if you're going to invest in your future, you're going to make sure you put that investment to work and get a return on your investment. And secondly, more areas in Canada have more access to affordable childcare than in the United States. and we have better maternity leave. Now, I said there were two reasons why we are doing better here in Canada than in the United States, apart from the regional disparities. Our unionization rate hasn't collapsed in the last 15, 20 years as it has in the United States in the private sector. It's not that robust, but it's better than it was in the United States. And, the attack on public sector unions is just beginning with things like Bill C-377 and some public sector measures that have been announced and pulled back on, but they haven't gone away in Saskatchewan. And I guess you could actually point to some other fights with public sector unions in Ontario and Nova Scotia and Quebec, all of which are related to keeping the deficit in check or to reducing the size of the deficit. So by and large, however, our unions are stronger here in Canada than are in the United States, which is why you should expect to see an accelerated fight to reduce their strength. But that is one of the reasons why our income is not as accentuated here as it is in the United States.
To end, I think that's a good point. I think that's something that actually Branko raised in the other interview, is that elites have increasingly been able to turn their economic power into political power. So we're seeing sort of greater consolidation at the top and into a sort of, whether you call it plutocracy or what have you. I'm guessing you would say that, is there also this risk of inequality undermining political institutions in Canada?
Oh, without question. I think if there aren't checks and balances in the democratic system, and by democratic systems, not just governments, but also unions. I mean, those two are really the only mechanisms we have in place in the economic and political worlds where the majority opinion counts. You have to organize yourself and make sure there's a mechanism for the majority opinion to count. And to the degree that people are walking away engagement with the political process, and to the degree that unions are being vilified too as a corrupt set of institutions, all you're left with, therefore, is what you can do for yourself. And we know from time immemorial that you're going to be outnumbered, you're going to be outgunned in terms of the heavyweights that are out there, particularly in an era in which we're seeing a wave of corporate consolidation post the 2008 crisis. The global commercial and corporate giants are getting bigger and bigger. And if you think you can out-muscle them on your own, you're out of your mind. Really, what is being quite effectively done in many public debates is vilifying the very thing bring us collective strength, which is through our governments. Don't forget, our governments are us. They're not them, they're us. We vote them. Our governments can make things better. Unions can make things better. We can really only make things better if we organize ourselves, just like the private sector does.
A tall task. Thanks a lot, Armin.
Okay, my pleasure, Michal, and thanks very much for inviting me to be part of this.
That was Armin Yalnızyan, senior economist with the CCPA. That's all for this week. You'll hear from me again in 2 weeks.